I want you to think about your last commercial flight. If you're anything like me, you were probably just entirely focused on the mundane, slightly annoying reality of modern flying.
Oh, absolutely. Hunting for cheap tickets online, complaining about the legroom.
Right? Or just silently praying the person in front of you wouldn't recline their seat all the way back. We really do treat hurtling through the stratosphere at like 500 miles an hour like a bus trip to the grocery store.
We completely take it for granted.
We do. But if you rewind to the early 1940s, jet-powered flight was viewed by much of the public, and frankly, even by scientists, as a mere laboratory experiment. I mean, people were incredibly skeptical.
And looking at the physics, they had really good reason to be. The materials used in those early prototype engines could barely survive a few hundred hours before they just, well, gave
I
in.
just melted, right?
Literally melted. So the contrast to today is just staggering. I mean, the efficiency, the payload capacity, the absolute reliability of modern commercial airliners, it surpassed even the wildest expectations of those early aviation pioneers.
And I think it's tempting for us to credit sleeker aerodynamics or maybe more refined aviation fuel for all that.
Right, but the real secret to modern air travel, better engine efficiency and reduced emissions, it isn't just about what we burn or how the wings are shaped.
No, it's about material science.
Exactly. Specifically, it's about this microscopic battle to prevent these massive, incredibly powerful jet engines from literally melting themselves from the inside out.
Which brings us to the stack of materials we have for you today for this deep dive. We've got everything from dense aerospace engineering journals to metallurgical research papers, even some cost analysis reports.
It's quite a mix.
Yeah, but the mission here is clear. We are going to unpack the invisible technology that actually keeps you alive at 35,000 feet. Because the basic rule of thermodynamics in a gas turbine is brutal.
It really is. I mean, to get better thermodynamic efficiency, meaning you extract more thrust and generate less pollution out of the fuel you burn, the engine has to run hotter.
Right, hotter is better for efficiency. But by the 1950s and 60s, the materials we were using to build these engines and the internal air cooling systems designed to protect them, they had essentially hit a physical brick wall.
Yeah, you simply couldn't push the internal temperature any higher without catastrophic failure.
So, okay, let's unpack this. The real heroes of the last 20 to 30 years aren't massive structural changes to the aircraft. They are highly engineered, microscopic layers of coatings.
We are talking about layers thinner than a human hair.
Which is wild. And these layers allow the gas temperatures inside the engine to rise by up to 110 degrees Celsius beyond the actual melting point of the metal itself.
Yeah, and what's fascinating here is to truly appreciate those microscopic layers, we first need to establish the sheer scale of the hostility inside that environment.
Paint a picture for us.
Okay, so when you look at the first row of blades in a high-pressure turbine, that's the part immediately following the combustion chamber. Those blades face gas entry temperatures of around 1400 degrees Celsius.
Wow.
To put that in perspective, that temperature is approaching, and in some localized spots, even exceeding the melting point of the metallic blade itself.
And while they are being blasted by this blinding inferno, those same blades are spinning at what, over 10,000 revolutions per minute?
Over 10,000 RPM,
I
yes.
mean, just think about those physics for a second. We're talking about a solid hunk of metal spinning at 10,000 RPM, subjected to astronomical centrifugal forces just trying to rip it apart, all while sitting in a gas stream hot enough to turn it into liquid soup.
The mechanical strain is almost incomprehensible. And the foundation of how we survive that strain is the metal itself. The industry typically uses a single crystal nickel-based superalloy.
Right, and one of the most flamous ones in the sources is called CMSX4.
Exactly. These superalloys are marvels of modern engineering. They achieve their exceptional strength at high temperatures because they are packed with refractory metals.
And for anyone who isn't a metallurgist, refractory metals are elements like tungsten, tantalum, and radium.
Right?
These are elements with insanely high melting points and incredibly stubborn atomic structures. So when you mix them into the nickel, they essentially pin the crystal lattice in place. They refuse to let the metal warp or stretch, even when it's glowing red hot.
That pinning effect is crucial for structural integrity. But, in engineering, you never get something for nothing.
There's always a trade-off.
Always. To pack the alloy full of those heavy, strong, refractory metals, metallurgists had to reduce the percentage of other elements, specifically chromium and aluminum.
And by dropping those elements, the superalloys sacrifice their environmental resistance, right?
Exactly. They lose their natural ability to fight off the chemical warfare happening inside the engine.
Because the research papers highlight this process called hot corrosion, jet fuel and the surrounding air aren't perfectly clean. You have all these salts and sulfur depositing from the vapor phase directly onto the engine parts.
It is a relentless chemical attack on the metal at extreme temperatures.
So without protection, that incredibly strong, very expensive single crystal blade will just rapidly rust, corrode, and essentially crumble to dust in the chemical crossfire.
Which is exactly where the first layer of our invisible shield comes in, the bond coat.
Ah, right. The aerospace industry uses specialized metallic coatings for this, known as aluminides, or this class of materials called MKRALY.
And funnily enough, material scientists actually pronounce that acronym MKRALY.
Which just sounds like a terrible 1990s DJ to me. And crawly in the house.
It really does. But reading through the chemical function of this MKRALY layer, its primary job isn't actually to be the final impenetrable barrier.
Wait, really?
No. Its job is to grow an incredibly thin, very slow-growing layer of oxide on the surface of the blade. Specifically, a very stable type of alumina called alpha-Al2O3.
Okay, so the formulation is highly intentional. When the MKRALY coating is exposed to that harsh, oxygen-rich environment of the turbine, it selectively reacts to form this tight, flawless layer of alumina.
Right, and that alumina acts as a physical barrier, sealing off the metal beneath it from any further chemical attack.
I like to picture it this way. It's like giving the engine blade a microscopic immune system.
That's a great analogy.
Thanks. So the bond coating acts as a hidden reservoir of aluminum. When the blade gets exposed to the harsh environment, the aluminum in the coating constantly sacrifices itself, migrating to the surface and reacting with the oxygen to build this perfect little alumina scab over the metal.
Yeah, exactly.
And if that scab gets scratched or damaged by microscopic debris passing through the engine, more aluminum diffuses up from the reservoir to heal it, just rebuilding the scab in real time.
And that biology analogy actually holds up remarkably well scientifically, because just like a biological immune system, that defense mechanism is dynamic, but it relies on a finite resource.
Right, the aluminum reservoir can be depleted.
It can. But what's truly fascinating is how researchers perfected this immune system through a series of accidental discoveries. I mean, if we look at the history of aluminide coatings, there is a famous plot twist involving platinum.
This was my absolute favorite part of the research.
It's so good.
So, in the early days of developing these coatings, scientists noticed a massive problem. The aluminum in the coating wasn't just migrating outward to form the protective scab.
Right. Because of the intense heat, it was also diffusing inward. It was dissolving deep into the base superalloy of the blade itself.
They were basically losing their aluminum reservoir to the inside of the blade.
And their solution was entirely logical at the time. They decided to put down a layer of platinum before applying the aluminide coating.
Right. The hypothesis was that the heavy, dense platinum atoms would act as a microscopic diffusion barrier, like a wall to stop the aluminum from leaking into the substrate.
Exactly. And they spent vast amounts of time and money developing this platinum wall.
Which makes perfect logical sense. You build a wall to keep the aluminum where it belongs. Except when they finally tested it, the platinum wall was a complete failure.
A total failure regarding its intended purpose, yeah. Platinum did absolutely nothing to stop the downward diffusion.
It actually made it worse, didn't it?
It did. Under the electron microscope, researchers realized the platinum actually enhanced the diffusion of aluminum into the base metal. It was essentially holding the door open.
So by all their initial logic, the experiment was a disaster.
But they noticed something inexplicable. Even though the aluminum was still diffusing inward, the platinum miraculously improved the adherence of the oxide scab on the outside.
It gripped the metal perfectly and drastically improved the hot corrosion resistance.
Yeah. They completely misunderstood what the platinum was doing, but the result was so good, literally tripling the lifespan of the turbine blades, that the industry just shrugged and kept using it anyway.
Science by accident. I love it. And reading further, that wasn't the only time they got the mechanism completely wrong.
Yeah.
There's a great myth involving the Y in that MKRALY coating.
Ah, yes. The Y stands for yttrium. For years, they added about 1% yttrium to the coating mix.
The famous yttrium peg theory.
That's the one. For a long time, the prevailing consensus in metallurgy was that this tiny addition of yttrium somehow encouraged the oxide scab to grow microscopic pegs down into the metallic coating.
So they believe these pegs physically anchored the protective scab to the surface so it wouldn't flake off under extreme stress.
Right, and again, it sounds perfectly reasonable. You want a scab to stay on during a hurricane, you peg it down.
But the truth is entirely different. The yttrium doesn't form structural pegs at all.
No, it doesn't.
Instead, it acts like a chemical sponge. There are tiny, unavoidable amounts of sulfur present in the engine environment and in the base alloys.
And at high temperatures, sulfur is notorious for migrating to the surface and completely ruining the adhesion of the oxide layer.
It basically poisons the glue holding the scab on.
Exactly. So the yttrium's real job is simply to hunt down that sulfur, chemically combine with it, and trap it so it can't destroy the bond. No pegs. Just a microscopic chemical cleanup crew.
It perfectly illustrates the sheer complexity of the chemical warfare happening on the surface of these blades. But we have to remember the fundamental limitation of everything we've discussed so far.
Right, because this bond coat, this incredible self-healing immune system, only stops chemical rust and corrosion.
It does virtually nothing to stop the sheer raw heat of the gas stream.
Nothing at all.
Wait, let's pause on that. If the immune system doesn't stop heat, and the blade is sitting in a 1400-degree inferno that exceeds its melting point, why doesn't the raw heat just melt right through the bond coat and turn the superalloy into a puddle?
Because the bond coat is only the first half of the equation. To survive the temperature, we need the thermal barrier coating, or TBC.
Oh.
If the bond coat is the windbreaker that stops the chemical wind, the TBC is the thick wool sweater that insulates the body.
The sweater concept. I like that. So the primary material used for this sweater is a highly engineered ceramic called yttria-stabilized zirconia, or YSZ.
Right. And ceramics are generally great insulators. Think of a ceramic coffee mug keeping your hands safe from boiling coffee.
But YSZ is special. First, the sources note that adding 5 to 15% yttria stabilizes the zirconia so it doesn't undergo phase transitions.
Which is critical, meaning as the jet engine rapidly heats up on takeoff and cools down on landing, the ceramic doesn't dramatically change its internal crystal structure and shatter.
It also has a thermal expansion coefficient incredibly close to the base metal, right?
Yes, allowing the metal and the ceramic to expand and contract together without tearing themselves apart.
But its true superpower lies in its microscopic atomic structure. YSZ is packed with what physicists call point defects.
Because when we think of heat traveling through a solid metal or ceramic, it isn't a hot fluid flowing through the material. Heat is a wave of vibrations passing through the atomic lattice.
What we call phonons.
Exactly, phonons.
So if heat is just atoms jiggling and passing that jiggle down the line, the point defects in this ceramic are basically atoms of different sizes that disrupt the pattern.
They literally scatter those lattice vibrations.
It's like trying to send a perfect rhythmic wave through a swimming pool filled with random boulders. The wave just breaks up, scatters, and loses its energy.
That's a perfect way to visualize it. It prevents the heat transfer on a fundamental atomic level.
And here's where it gets really interesting. The effectiveness of that scattering is hard to overstate. This advanced ceramic sweater we are putting on the blade is astonishingly thin.
We are talking about a layer only 1/5 of a millimeter thick.
Just 1/5 of a millimeter. But because of how perfectly it scatters those vibrations, that fraction of a millimeter is enough to drop the temperature between the scorching gas stream and the metal surface by a massive 100, 300 degrees Celsius.
It's incredible.
That is mind-blowing. 1/5 of a millimeter of stone is the only thing standing between a safely functioning commercial aircraft and a catastrophic engine meltdown.
But the research points out a massive catch to using YSE.
There's always a catch.
Always. Ceramics like YSE are what metallurgists call oxygen transparent.
Oxygen transparent. What does that mean in practice?
Well, they are fantastic at blocking heat vibrations, but at those extreme temperatures, oxygen atoms can easily slip right through the gaps in the ceramic structure.
Oh, wow. So the wool sweater keeps you warm, but the oxygen wind blows right through it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And this is exactly why the bond coat, the windbreaker, is strictly necessary.
Because if you were to apply the ceramic directly onto the superalloy blade, the temperature would drop, but the oxygen passing through the ceramic would instantly oxidize and destroy the blade underneath.
You'd save it from the heat just to lose it to the rust. So the ceramic drops the temperature to a survivable level, and the bond coat catches the oxygen passing through to form that protective alumina scab.
It's a perfectly codependent system.
It really is.
Which brings up a huge practical question. Mechanics. How exactly do you get these miracle ceramics onto a complex, curved engine blade? You obviously don't just, brush it on in a factory.
Oh, no. The manufacturing processes are intense. There are two major methods used in the industry, and they result in completely different microscopic structures.
Okay, what's the first one?
The first is APS, or air plasma spray. Imagine blasting ceramic powder particles through an ionized gas plasma torch operating at a balmy 16,000 degrees Celsius.
That is hotter than the surface of the sun.
It is. The particles melt instantly and are fired at the blade at speeds of 200 to 300 meters per second.
So they hit the blade like tiny meteors and instantly splat, creating this porous, pancake-like layer upon layer.
Yes. Pancakes is the perfect way to describe it. And because of the way those pancakes stack up, APS leaves microscopic pores and boundaries that lie parallel to the surface of the blade.
Meaning they are perpendicular to the flow of heat trying to get in.
Right. Because heat struggles to jump across those gaps, APS creates an incredibly good insulator. The thermal conductivity is remarkably low, around 0.9 to 1 watts per meter Kelvin.
Okay, so that's the first method.
Then you have the second method, EBPVD.
Which stands for Electron Beam Physical Vapor Deposition.
Yes. This is an entirely different approach. You place the turbine blade in a high vacuum chamber, and you shoot a high-powered electron beam at a solid ingot of the ceramic until the rock literally boils and evaporates.
Do you boil a rock?
You boil a rock. The ceramic vapor then drifts up and condenses onto the relatively cooler blade.
Hold on. You just said EBPVD relies on vapor condensing. And the research shows that when it condenses, it doesn't form flat pancakes.
No, it doesn't.
It forms microscopic vertical columns growing straight up from the surface of the blade, kind of like a microscopic forest of stalagmites.
Right, a columnar structure.
But if I'm heat, I'm just going to travel straight down those solid columns right into the metal. Wouldn't the APS pancakes be vastly superior at blocking the heat? Why on earth do jet manufacturers prefer the columns for flight?
Well, if you only cared about insulation, you'd be absolutely right. The thermal conductivity of the EBPVD columns is almost double that of the APS pancakes. It lets far more heat through.
So why use it?
Because we have to factor in the mechanical reality of a jet engine. These blades aren't just getting hot. They are subjected to massive dynamic mechanical strain from spinning at 10,000 RPM, experiencing extreme turbulence and rapid thermal cycling.
Right. All that bending and stretching.
Exactly. The pancake structure of APS is relatively brittle. Under that kind of dynamic flexing, the pancakes crack, delaminate, and peel off in large chunks.
Which would be catastrophic at altitude.
Highly catastrophic. But the EBPVD coating, because it's made of millions of independent microscopic columns, can actually flex and stretch as the metal blade bends under strain.
Oh, I see. The tops of the columns just separate slightly from each other without snapping the base of the coating.
Exactly. In the violent environment of a jet engine, that columnar structure leads to an 8 to 13 times longer life for the coating.
So you willingly sacrifice a significant amount of insulation just to get the flexibility required to survive the mechanical stress.
It's all about that trade-off.
Though looking at the RWE energy stats in our sources, it's worth noting that for massive land-based gas turbines used in power generation, the ones that basically sit stationary in a power plant and run at constant speeds for up to 9 years, continuously, they don't actually need that flexibility.
Right, because they don't experience the crazy dynamic strain of an airplane. The power industry actually prefers the APS pancake method to get that superior insulation.
It really all comes down to managing this specific environment. And managing that environment is staggeringly expensive.
Oh, the cost is astronomical. Applying these coatings isn't just technologically difficult.
The numbers are eye-watering. A single set of high-pressure turbine blades for a large power generation turbine costs around 1.5 million British pounds.
And because the internal aluminum reservoir eventually depletes and the ceramic degrades, they have to be regularly removed and replaced.
Just the process of chemically stripping the old coatings and recoating the set of blades can cost up to 1 million pounds.
And that staggering financial burden drives an enormous amount of ongoing metallurgical research. Companies need to predict exactly when these coatings will fail.
Because you don't want to replace a million-pound coating a year too early, but you definitely cannot afford to let it fail in service.
Which would destroy the entire engine.
Which introduces a darker twist to this incredible engineering. We've talked about these layers like they are purely protective armor.
Right.
But mechanically, we have just glued three entirely different materials together.
Yeah.
A single crystal nickel superalloy, a metallic bond coat, and a ceramic top coat.
Three very different materials.
They all have different atomic structures, they react differently to heat, and they stretch at different rates.
And this is where the research from Svetlana Stekovic at Linköping University becomes highly relevant. She studies the unintended consequences of applying these protective coatings.
The fatigue paradox.
Yes. Specifically looking at low cycle fatigue, or LCF, and thermomechanical fatigue, TMF. Because these three materials have a mismatch in their thermal expansion coefficients and their ductility, the very coatings designed to save the blade can actually cause it to tear itself apart from the inside.
When I was reading Stekovic's paper on these fatigue tests, the paradox she uncovered blew my mind.
It's so counterintuitive.
She ran rigorous fatigue tests on coated superalloys, physically pulling and heating them to simulate the exact stress of a running engine. And she found that at a lower temperature of 500 degrees Celsius, applying these protective coatings actually significantly harms the blade's overall lifespan.
You put the armor on and the lifespan drops.
How is that possible?
Well, at 500 degrees, the metallic bond coats, particularly the aluminide ones, are operating below what material scientists call their ductile brittle transition temperature.
Meaning they're incredibly stiff and brittle at that temperature.
Very brittle. So as the nickel metal blade underneath tries to naturally flex under the centrifugal load of the engine, the stiff, brittle coating fractures.
And here's the truly dangerous part. Those microscopic cracks don't just stay in the coating layer.
No, they don't. The stress concentration at the tip of the crack drives it straight down into the expensive superalloy substrate, causing premature failure of the entire blade.
So if we use that analogy from earlier, the armor we put on the knight to protect them in battle is actually so stiff and rigid that it drives a dagger into the knight's ribs the moment they try to swing their sword.
That is a very grim but highly accurate way to visualize it. But then, Stekovic tested those exact same coated blades at 900 degrees Celsius.
A much higher temperature.
And the physical script completely flips. At 900 degrees, the aluminide coating passes its transition point. It becomes highly ductile.
Ah, so it can stretch, yield, and flow with the metal.
Exactly. At this extreme higher temperature, the coatings perform beautifully. They stretch without snapping. They actively prevent oxidation from attacking any microflaws on the surface. And they actually extend the fatigue life of the metal compared to a bare, uncoated blade.
So the armor only works when you are literally standing in the fire.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it perfectly demonstrates that advanced aerospace engineering is rarely about finding a flawless, zero-compromise solution. It is a continuous exercise in managing complex, intercepting trade-offs.
Which you see so clearly in Stekovic's out-of-phase thermomechanical fatigue tests, the OPTMF tests.
Yes, the absolute worst-case scenario.
Let's define out-of-phase for the listener. That means the maximum physical pulling stress on the blade and the extreme heating of the blade don't happen at the exact same time during the flight cycle.
Precisely. In a real operating engine, the maximum tensile stress, the physical pulling force on the blade, often peaks when the blade is at a relatively lower temperature during the flight cycle. For example, during a sudden transition in throttle.
So the blade is being pulled its absolute hardest, right when the coating is in its cold, brittle state.
Right. And the OPTMF tests prove that this out-of-phase cycle creates surface cracks in the brittle coating during the cold pulling phase.
And then, moments later, when the engine heat catches up, the oxygen rushes straight down into those fresh cracks, rapidly accelerating internal oxidation and destroying the metal from the inside out.
It is a vicious combined attack that dramatically shortens the life of the entire system.
When you lay it all out like that, it's a miracle we ever leave the runway. So what does this all mean for you, listening right now?
I think it really changes things.
It does. I think it means that the next time you're sitting on a commercial jet, hunting for the armrest, and you hear the deep roar of those turbine engines spool up for takeoff, maybe take a second to look past the wings and the fuel tanks.
Try to picture that invisible microscopic battle happening just inches away from you.
Yeah, picture that 1/5 of a millimeter of highly engineered ceramic and that microscopic chemical immune system fighting a desperate, continuous war against 1,400 degree heat, 10,000 RPM stresses, and relentless chemical corrosion. It completely changes how you view the everyday miracle of modern flight.
It really does reframe the experience. But to leave you with one final, perhaps slightly unsettling thought to ponder on your own based on the material we've discussed today.
Oh boy. Okay, let's hear it.
Well, since the ceramic thermal barrier is entirely transparent to oxygen, and the metallic bond coat underneath relies on a finite, limited reservoir of aluminum that slowly depletes over time as it constantly sacrifices itself to form its protective scab.
Wait, I see where you're going with this.
You have to ask yourself, are we essentially flying on borrowed time the moment the engine starts, just waiting for that microscopic well of aluminum to finally run dry?
Now, there is a terrifying thought to keep you occupied during turbulence. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Stay curious, keep asking questions, and we will catch you next time.